Money talks and something else walks. That's an old expression that I'm sure you've heard, and it voices the truism that if you really want to know what's important to somebody, look at what he spends his money on. Don't show me your speeches. Show me your budget. Well, our Supreme Court has recognized the importance of money, but it's also recognized something else, that money, in some sense, can constitute speech, free expression. And this causes a problem when Congress or state legislature tries to limit the way we raise and spend money in political campaigns. Today, we'll speak with author Derek Cressman about his new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Derek Cressman is a fascinating fellow. He's what you might call a man with a cause. And Derek's cause is campaign finance reform, getting money out of politics. He's been working at this for decades now. He's worked for something called the Public Interest Research Group. He's also been a vice president of a group you may have heard of called Common Cause, which champions many good government issues, and certainly perhaps chief among them is campaign finance reform. As you might guess, Derek's not a big fan of the Citizens United case decided back there in 2010, which struck down some of the more powerful and recent campaign finance laws in this country. Unlike most of us, though, he has devoted himself to figuring out exactly what we can do about it, if in fact we agree with him. He's written a book. It's called When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. And I think the title pretty much says it all. And in that book, Derek has some very specific suggestions, specific strategies that he wants people to follow to overturn Citizens United.
The rich and powerful have always been rich and powerful, right? And money in politics has always been a part of that. But one of the things that I found in researching the book is it has gotten better and gotten much worse over various times in our history. So this is not just some inevitable fact of life. And in fact, it's gotten quite a bit worse over the past 40 years, not by accident or fate, but by intentional decision by the Supreme Court that I think was misguided. But for folks who are interested, it didn't make it into the main book. It's funny, I had a conversation with my publisher about this book. He said, "That's fantastic, but you got to make it shorter." So. Mm-hmm. Which actually is one of the key points in the book that we can get to about how we all have limited time to consume information. But there is a chapter in what's called the bonus chapters that's available for free for anybody who wants it at whenmoneytalks.com that goes over the history of how the Congress and state legislatures and sometimes the people themselves through state initiatives have enacted very tough campaign finance laws that oftentimes worked very well until they were struck down by the courts.
Yeah, that is a constant pull and push. In fact, I have recently, just this morning, in fact, I was discussing the Lochner era with my introductory constitutional law class. And that's really the only way to understand the change in the laws dramatically occurred in 1937 because we went from one era to another era over a very short period of time. And the Lochner era was a time when the pendulum was swinging very much in favor of the big money interests. And then post-Lochner, at least for a few decades after 1937, it was swinging very much in the opposite direction. But your point is that it started to swing back toward the big money interests. I'm going to guess, what, around 1975, 1980?
Yes. Actually, the 1980 presidential election was perhaps the one in the country that had the least amount of influence of big money in politics.
Well, that's interesting.
You had both Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan running under this brand new system of public financing of campaigns, so they were not accepting large contributions for their campaigns. There were no super PACs. There was no soft money. So But then things began to unravel quite a bit after that. In the 1980s, you start having political parties bypassing those laws through what they called soft money at the time.
Right. Now, those laws grew out of the post-Watergate era, right?
That's right.
Okay, so there's this great cataclysm. There's this great loss of confidence in the political system after Watergate. So a lot of these campaign finance laws get passed in the 1970s. What was the first major decision that the court had opining on these laws?
Well, that first ruling came in 1976, almost exactly 40 years ago as we're talking, end of January 1976, and it was known as the Buckley versus Vallejo ruling. Mm-hmm. And it was reacting to a 1974 law passed by the Congress that did a number of things. The most important thing is that it set mandatory limits on how much each campaign for Congress or each candidate for Congress could spend, so that there'd be a level playing field of both sides spending the same amount of money. Secondly, it set a limit on contributions of how much any wealthy individual could give to a campaign, although that limit was fairly high at the time. It was $1,000, which seems quaint right now, but back then that was larger than almost anybody was actually writing in terms of a check to a congressional campaign. So it was really, you know, it was a little bit like passing a speed limit of 250 miles per hour.
Right.
You know, you're only going to impact the Maseratis, but most people, you know, couldn't get there if they tried. And then the third big piece of that was the public financing system for presidential campaigns. And what the court did in 1976 is it struck down the toughest provision of that law, the mandatory equal spending limits. It upheld the contribution limits, which were so high as to be almost toothless. But then they did uphold that public financing system, which, as I mentioned, did work quite well in the 1980 presidential campaign and for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Okay, before we go on, and I really do want to hear that, but I wanted to first, you know, establish exactly what this law did. And it's a remarkable law, if you think about it. Let's take them one at a time. That first provision that everybody is going to spend only the same amount on a particular congressional race, that was revolutionary. I mean, the very idea that you automatically set an inequality of effective speech, of campaign speech, so that everybody has an equal chance to make his or her case, no matter which party they're from or whether they're not even from a party, that was revolutionary. I find it remarkable that Congress would ever pass such a law.
Well, that's a good point, and it's worth remembering this history when you encounter cynics today who say Congress never will pass a law like this, because in fact they have. And even more remarkable is that it wasn't revolutionary at that time. Several states had been passing laws similar to this going back to the early 1900s, so it was not a radical idea. And in fact, it's an idea that we continue to employ all of the time. If you go to a city council meeting and there's a public comment period, in almost every city I've been in, each citizen gets to stand up and they get to talk for 1 minute or 2 minutes, or maybe it's three, but there's an equal limit that each side can speak to an issue. The Supreme Court does this themselves when lawyers come to make their oral arguments. Each side will usually get 30 minutes. So it's not really a revolutionary or radical idea that we're going to limit each speaker so that every speaker has a chance to be heard equally. We do that all the time when we want a decision to be made on the merits rather than on, you know, the strength of someone's voice, or in this case, the thickness of their pocketbook.
But the Supreme Court struck that part down, and what was the basis in the Buckley case for them striking that part of the law down?
Well, what they said was it's wholly foreign to the First Amendment to limit the voice of one speaker in order to enhance the value of another. So in other words, we cannot level the playing field. And yet, as I pointed out, we do that all the time, and it, in fact, is not wholly foreign to the First Amendment. It is vital to upholding the principle of the First Amendment of freedom of speech for the people, to limit the volume and duration of speech of any one person. So intellectually, I think the court was on very shaky ground, and the reason for that is the court was just really grasping for some compromise. You had a wide divergence of opinion from the justices. You had a case that was brought up in unusual expedited fashion, so they were looking at zero factual record and just sort of conjecturing as to how it might work. And they made a bad decision.
And before they even got to that point, they had to decide that money and speech are one and the same, at least in the political context.
That's right. And, you know, there are parts of that that make sense, in that many forms of mass communication today require somebody needs to spend funds. To sell the New York Times, you're hiring newspaper reporters and buying newsprint and all these things. There are expenditures involved. But what the court conflated was that idea of the free press, where money is being spent, but ultimately it is coming from the consumers of the information. People subscribe to the New York Times. They tune in and watch Fox News or MSNBC or your program right now. And that is the core of the free press that the framers had in mind, and it's very different from forced speech that you see in paid advertising, where we're going to give the listener a message that they did not buy. The speaker paid for it, not the listener. And they wouldn't normally be seeking out. And that's a line between paid speech and free speech that the court failed to draw in Buckley and has continued to fail to draw to this day.
That's an interesting distinction. And let's just explore it a little bit further. So you think there's a distinct difference between what you call forced speech, which is something the speaker pays for, and something which in some sense is at least difficult to avoid. If I want to watch a television program, then I'm probably going to be exposed to the commercial, even though I theoretically can mute it on my television set. You think that's distinct from speech that I decide I want to listen to and go and pay for example, when I subscribe to a particular channel or when I go out and buy a particular newspaper. Why is that different again?
Well, the difference comes back to the reality that we all have limited time to consume information. And in fact, we are drowning in a sea of information, far more so than at any point in our history. You know, our email inboxes are overflowing, our voicemail boxes are full. We have hundreds of channels to choose from on cable TV. And so, and yet we have a limited capacity to absorb information in our brains. So the fundamental prerequisite for self-government is autonomy of citizens to be able to pick and choose for themselves what information to hear. And, you know, in past generations, the great concern was government censorship, preventing people from having access to that information. But I think we're facing a very different kind of threat today, where we have the speech of the loudest, or really the speech of the wealthiest, drowning out the viewpoints of others. So we no longer have a balanced debate, and we've impaired our ability for each citizen to think autonomously and choose for themselves what information is important to them.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm speaking with author Derek Cressman about his new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and maybe even a couple of them, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Derek. Stick around. Now it's that time again, time for our constitutional quiz. And in just a second here, you'll hear me and the quiz guy with not just one, but maybe a couple of constitutional quizzes that were recorded before a live audience in Colonial Williamsburg at the 2016 We the People competition. This is going to be fun.
I'm from Glasgow Middle School. My name is Alex.
All right.
All right, Alex. Well, I'm going to read the question. I'm going to give you four choices. Okay? The right choice gets you a prize. Here it comes. Where can you find the room where James Madison studied in preparation for the Constitutional Convention and began drafts of the Virginia Plan? Is it A, Williamsburg, Virginia? B, Montpelier, the home of James Madison?
It's not that one.
C, Lincoln, Nebraska? Or D, it was in a pineapple under the sea?
I think Williamsburg?
In Williamsburg, Virginia. We're in Williamsburg right now. And Williamsburg is a very historical place. And you think James Madison was in Williamsburg when he studied to get ready to prepare the Constitution of the United States of Virginia plan? Yes?
He's changing his answer.
Oh, he's changing his answer. Well, that's answer choice A. Think about that one. Okay, answer choice B.
Can we give him a second to think about it?
Yeah.
No,
so I would just like to remind you
that
the home of James Madison is putting this on, Montpelier.
I'm going to say Montpelier.
You're right!
That's amazing!
Yes!
Come on up, Alex!
What you don't know is because he referred to Montpelier or James Madison, he also got a magnet. That's how we roll.
That's our not-so-secret word. Okay, tremendous.
My name's Jack, and I'm from Brown Academy.
All right. Jack from Brown Academy. How old are you, Jack?
13.
13 years old. All right. Do we have a question for Jack?
We do have a question for Jack. How you doing, Jack?
Good.
How'd your team do?
Good.
Yeah? You felt pretty good about it?
Yeah.
Good. Here comes the question. I'll read the question and give you four choices.
Okay.
Please wait for the fourth choice. What college has the most power over the election of the President of the United States? Is it the College of William and Mary? Is it Yale? Is it Princeton University, where James Madison attended?
He did.
Or is it the Electoral College?
The Electoral College.
Wait a second. I don't know. Are you sure of that answer?
Yeah.
You sure you don't want to poll the audience to see if they agree with you? Do we agree with Jack?
It's the Electoral
College. See a show of hands if you agree with Jack. No? How many votes for Yale? Yeah?
Yaleys?
I don't know, no. Jack. I think Yale might have it. You're not going to be swayed?
Do you want me to read the question again?
The Electoral College.
I think Jack's sticking with the Electoral College.
He's right!
All right, Jack!
The Electoral College! Well done. Well done.
There aren't a lot of functioning democracies around the world that work this way, where you can basically have millionaires and billionaires bankrolling whoever they want, however they want, in some cases undisclosed. And what it means is ordinary Americans are shut out of the process.
Americans have always been skeptical of corporate power. In fact, this country was founded by a revolt against the biggest corporation of its day, the British East India Company. You know how conservatives are always going on about how the Boston Tea Party was an example of America's anti-government roots? Well, the Boston Tea Party was actually an anti-corporate protest, not an anti-government one. And it was not some 18th century version of an Americans for Tax Reform Tea Party rally.
Money, 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 money.
Why is it that every election season it becomes impossible to hear the facts over all these misleading ads? And if it seems the problem is only getting worse, that's because it is. We can thank the Supreme Court for that. In 2010, they decided that it would be just fine for corporations to spend as much money as they want telling us who to vote for. Wait, why are corporations telling us who to vote for? Let's get something straight. This is a democracy, you know, ruled by the people. I'm a person, you're a person, and Chevron, not a person. So shouldn't elections be all about what people want? Good jobs, safe products, healthcare, responsible government, clean air and water. It turns out the vast majority of Americans want to see a lot more done on all of these things. But what people want is going to take a back seat as long as corporations can spend millions getting lawmakers elected.
Why do we have such anti-free market silliness in the United States? Here's what we know. There's an extraordinary amount of campaign cash inside of the market and economy that produces these political results. ADM, of course, has literally spent millions of dollars to push for corn subsidies. And if it's because of these interventions that we've seen the changes we've seen, then we can say campaign money has distorted the market, which has distorted food production, which has distorted our kids.
Here's my proposal for campaign finance reform. Public financing of elections. Why? Because people work for the folks who pay them. Right now, our politicians are paid by the lobbyists. So they work for them, not us.
More speech is never a bad thing, whether it's funded by Citizens United or by Microsoft or by the Teamsters Union. And it's especially not a bad thing right before an election when politics matters most. If you want to get exercised over something, don't get bent out of shape over a court ruling that actually increases free speech. Instead, turn your ire on a government that is vast and growing and helps or hinders corporations based on political lobbying rather than marketplace forces.
I will make it absolutely a priority to finally, whether it's through Supreme Court appointments or constitutional amendment, to get rid of Citizens United and its pernicious effects on our electoral system.
I love the idea of campaign finance reform. And one of the things you should do is... everybody should be known. If somebody gives $1 million or $2 million or $5 million, it should be known.
Tragically, and I say these words advisedly, we are well on our way to seeing our great country move toward an oligarchic form of government where virtually all economic and political power rests with a handful of very wealthy families.
A small piece of paper, it carries a lot of weight for that me.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to return to my conversation with Derek Cressman, the author of When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. Now, the most familiar case to most people these days regarding campaign finance is the case of Citizens United. But before you get there, you got to go back in time a little bit to a very important case from 1976 called Buckley versus Valeo, and we had just gotten to that point before we took our break.
So you disagree with both parts of the Supreme Court's analysis, and at least that first aspect of Buckley. You don't agree that all money is speech, and you don't agree that even if it is speech, that it's beyond regulation.
That's right. You know, clearly, the way Justice Stevens said it is money is property. It is not speech. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't use that property to enhance your speech. So I do think that there are and should be some constitutional protections, even for paid speech. But then I think the court got it wrong when it said, a level playing field is not a good reason to put limits on that paid speech.
Very interesting. Okay, well, that leaves two other parts of Buckley. You say that the court did uphold limitations on contributions.
That's right.
That's an interesting distinction. Now, I wonder why they upheld limits on contributions. If money is speech, then, you know, my contribution is also speech. If I decide to give $100, that means I think this candidate's worth $100. If I decide to give $1,000, that must mean that I think the candidate's 10 times better. So how did they differentiate that? Why did they decide they were going to allow those sorts of limitations?
Yeah, I suspect the real reason is they wanted to strike a compromise and uphold some parts of the law and not others. But that to get to that conclusion, they had to do some mental gymnastics. And this is where they came up with the logic of corruption. And they said, well, if I give a candidate a direct contribution, that can be a little bit like a bribe. It might unduly influence that candidate to be favorable to me if they should win office. And
right.
that that corruption or even the risk of corruption there means that that is a good reason to limit money in politics, even if we are going to say money is speech. And, you know, we've seen that logic devolve to the point of just being a complete sham, where, you know, we now have the Supreme Court saying, well, if I give you as a candidate $1 million, that will clearly corrupt you. So we need to put a limit on that. But if I give $1 million to the super PAC that is working very hard to elect you, surely you won't be influenced by that at all. So that's completely okay.
Okay.
And I'm not really sure anybody believes that to be true, other than, you know, these five guys on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Understood. Okay. So that's the second part of Buckley. And then they ultimately then also agreed that they would allow public financing of the presidential race. Now, that's something that seems almost anachronistic now because nobody talks about it anymore. What was that part of the statute? And is that still good law?
Well, it's still on the books, but whether it's, you know, so it's good law legally, but the trouble is almost no candidates are using the system anymore, except for, I believe, Martin O'Malley is.
And what is the system again?
This is a system whereby when you would gain a certain amount of small contributions under $200, you would get a lump sum of public financing from the federal government if you also abide to state-by-state spending limits. And those spending limits made sense in 1974 when Congress wrote that law. But what we started seeing in the last 15 years is candidates who opted out of that system and said, I don't want the public funds because I can raise so much more by taking the big contributions and outspending my opponents in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. So we saw Barack Obama become the first candidate in the general election to refuse the public financing system. And no candidate since has done that. That was in his first election back in 2008. So
okay. But after
Congress has not updated those limits and added to the funding in a way to keep up with the private funds. So individual candidates, it no longer really makes sense for them to use the system. But it is still on the books, and they're very of this system that are on the books in the states that are still working, although the Supreme Court is again chipping away at the viability of those systems.
Okay. But as of 76, part of the statute's still viable, and you were telling me that in the 1980 election it worked pretty much as designed?
That's right. You had both Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter participating under the system. They both spent very little time raising money and most of their time out campaigning. You didn't see anybody renting out the Lincoln bedroom to donors to their political parties, as we later saw under President Clinton. You just didn't see the predominance of big donors in the way that we do today. So that's an example of how it is possible to craft policies that work if you keep them updated and keep them enforced and don't blow holes through them with Supreme Court rulings.
Is that what happened in the 1980s?
Well, what happened in the 1980s and the 2000s is political consultants like Dick Morris found loopholes around these contribution limits that existed for candidates and parties. And we've seen the creation of different flavors of outside groups ever since that time. So the first outside group was the political parties accepting soft money. And then it was an entity called 527 organizations, which were very active in the 2000 election, torpedoing John McCain's presidential campaign during the primaries.
And the basic idea there is that the limits that are placed upon fundraising are limits placed upon the campaigns themselves.
Well, the candidates themselves.
The candidates
but
themselves.
But not so-called outside or independent campaigns.
Okay, so that's the loophole you can drive a truck through. So if I'm running, right, Stuart Harris for Congress, I can only accept certain sorts of campaign contributions up to certain limits. But if you decide that I'm the best candidate for Congress, you can go out and form one of these other outside groups and not suffer under any such limitation.
Right. So in effect, we no longer really have contribution limits that work.
So this was just lawyers doing or consultants doing what they do best, which is finding ways around the dams that had been erected. The money was flowing through different channels, but still finding its way into the campaigns.
That's right. And that leads some people to conclude that, you know, because lawyers and consultants will always do what they're best, it's simply hopeless to have campaign finance laws. But, you know, that's a bit like arguing that, well, we can't have taxes either.
I was about to say that sounds awfully like the tax code. I mean, you come up with a certain idea for a tax, and the very first thing that people who can afford it do is they go out and hire lawyers and accountants to figure ways around it. And in fact, that's what tax law is.
People are finding ways around our prohibitions on murder and rape and robbery too, but that doesn't mean that we should legalize all of those things. It means that we need enforcement regimes that are robust and that are continually updated and strongly enforced. And the challenge that we face when it comes to money in politics is incumbent legislators often have an incentive to let these laws become dated and let these loopholes flourish because they benefit from them. But as incumbents, they have much greater fundraising advantages, and so they're not very aggressive at closing these loopholes. And when you compound that problem with then the courts adding more loopholes, you get a system that no longer works. But that doesn't mean that any system can ever work.
It sounds like we had a great shining moment, if you will, for campaign finance reform in the wake of Watergate. But then when it was necessary to continue fine-tuning the system, that the political will had evaporated by that time. But constitutionally speaking, the problem, of course, with limiting outside speech is that, golly, where does one draw the line? Does that mean that I'm simply not able to go out and express myself with regard to candidates or issues that I care about? I mean, is that what would closing those loopholes involve?
No, there are two places that we can draw that line. The first line is the difference between paid speech and free speech. So if you as an individual want to go out and express your opinion about any candidate for any office, there are a lot of options for that that don't involve you spending any money. You can write a letter to the editor of any newspaper. These days, you can post a blog or a tweet or share on social media. There are a lot of free press opportunities available to the ordinary citizen. Mm-hmm. So that's the first line. It is certainly anything where you're not spending money, and there are a lot of opportunities for that. Knock on your neighbor's door, walk a precinct. But then on the other side of that line, the next question is, okay, we don't want to ban paid speech, but we want to set a limit that ensures that we don't have billionaires drowning out the voices of everyone else. And the best articulation of that standard that I've seen came in the case Shrink Missouri Government PAC versus Federal Election Commission. And the standard was saying we should set limits that allow candidates and campaigns to rise to the level of notice through paid speech, but not to the level of overwhelming other voices in the debate.
Very interesting. Okay, so we didn't have the political will to enact such things. There were constitutional arguments on both sides of whether those things would have been constitutional, though I understand certainly that you're in favor of them. So what happened next in this saga once we got past the 1980s?
Well, the courts continued to weaken those post-Watergate rules, and the most significant and visible weakening of that was the Citizens United ruling that came in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Give us a brief thumbnail sketch of that one.
Sure. That was addressing a law passed by Congress, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, that was aiming to close some of these loopholes. So again,
that was the McCain-Feingold Act, right?
That's right.
Right.
And we did have the political will.
Right, and that was passed. What year was that passed?
That was passed, I believe it was in 2001.
Okay, so we actually have had some recent attempts, again, to revisit campaign finance reform on a national level.
That's
so
right.
We had this relatively new thing. And what did McCain-Feingold do?
Well, the two big pieces of it. First of all, it said political parties were going to apply contribution limits to them again, no matter what they're spending their funds on. So that was ending the so-called soft money loophole. So, you know, your political party couldn't just take $1 million check on your behalf for your congressional campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second piece is it applied a ban on corporate treasury funds and labor union treasury funds to these outside campaigns that promoted or attacked candidates close to election times. And that was, again, upholding the spirit of a law that goes back to 1907, the Tillman Act, that banned corporate contributions to candidates. Mm-hmm. This loophole had evolved of, again, instead of giving the money straight to the candidate, you spend it on an independent campaign. McCain-Feingold law said you can't use corporate treasury funds to do that. You have to use individual contributions from your shareholders or union members to do that.
And the rationale there, I think going all the way back to the early 20th century, is that corporations are not human beings. Corporations are what lawyers will call legal fictions. They are associations of people, typically, if they're for profit, to make money, but they can also be nonprofits as well. They are legal entities in the sense that they can conduct business of one form or another, that they can be sued, and they can sue other entities. So in some sense, they operate as human beings would, but the very word corporation suggests that they don't even really have bodies. They're something we're creating out of thin air for specific purposes, and I guess there's always been a thought that that's not something that has at least a First Amendment right. And so that's sort of the rationale for that sort of campaign finance reform, isn't it?
That's right. Now, obviously, a corporation or a labor union is comprised of real
of individuals, right? That's the counterargument.
Those individuals do have constitutional rights,
mm-hmm.
even if the legal entity that they're organizing themselves through does not. And so what this idea, going back to the Tillman Act of 1907 and reinforced by the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002 was, okay, if you're a group of people, we're going to give you a set of privileges to organize yourselves for an economic purpose because we want to give you an incentive to do that so we can have big economic ventures in our country, like build a canal or an automobile factory or whatnot. So we're going to give you those privileges for the economic sphere, and shareholders are going to invest in you for an economic purpose. But if you want to organize yourselves for a political purpose, you can't use those economic advantages. You need to create a political organization that operates by the same rules that every other political organization in the country operates by.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, you disclose your donors, and there was a $5,000 limit on PACs, or political action committees, which were political organizations made of real people, on how much they could give to a candidate or accept from an individual.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Derek Cressman about his new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. Stick around. Listening to your weekly constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my conversation with Derek Cressman, all about his new book, in which he tells us how we can reverse the notorious Citizens United campaign finance case.
So that was the rationale, and this is what Congress worked to reinforce in 2002 with McCain-Feingold, and those ideas were upheld by the Supreme Court under Justice Rehnquist. That began to unravel then in 2010 with the Citizens United ruling, where the court said, well, we know we upheld this idea just a few years ago, but we're going to backtrack.
What was the name of that case that Rehnquist was Chief Justice with?
So the it was McConnell versus FEC, Mitch McConnell, who fought tooth and nail to defeat these provisions in the U.S. Senate and ultimately lost that battle. Then fought tooth and nail in court to defeat them in court, and
but
lost
the Supreme,
again.
But the Supreme Court upheld it in the McConnell case. Okay,
that's right. And then what we saw was a change in personnel in the court, swapping out Rehnquist for Roberts and O'Connell for Alito, I believe it was.
Uh-huh. And those Justice O'Connor, for Alito,
yeah, ruled differently. Just 8 years later, showing little disregard for precedents of a recent Republican court, showing no regard for the decisions of a Republican President George Bush and a Republican President Gerald Ford that had signed these laws into law. And I think being highly inventive of the words that you actually find in the U.S. Constitution.
Okay, well, let's talk now that we've finally gotten to it, Citizens United. What happened there in 2010?
In Citizens United, the court struck down this prohibition on using corporate treasury funds for outside advertisements. And they did it in the context of this very unusual case and arguably a manufactured case that was designed to arrive just at this precedent. But you had a nonprofit corporation called Citizens United that wanted to put out a movie that was critical of a presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton. And that, I would be the first to say, is a First Amendment protected issue. Because, that's the freedom of the press, whether it's a movie or a newspaper or a book.
Yeah.
You can publish any of those things, and people can buy the book or pay to see the movie, and we do not want limits on that. But then they
it's sometimes called core political speech. It's the most protected form of speech. So if somebody picked the case very well.
That's right. Somebody picked the case very well, and that somebody is a guy named James Bopp, a very smart lawyer in Indiana who spent his whole career working to dismantle campaign finance laws. And he quite correctly saw the facts of this case as perfect for him to achieve his objectives. So what they then said is, well, okay, so we can put out a movie, that's fine, but that means we can also run 30-second ads advertising the movie that also happen to criticize a presidential campaign. And this would be like the New York Times going, well, we're a press outlet, so, freedom of the press means that we can buy ads on Monday Night Football, attacking Bernie Sanders, right? Because they just endorsed Hillary Clinton the other day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would say that just because they're a press organization, it means that they're exempt from campaign finance rules outside of their own press outlet. And yet that's what the court ruled in the Citizens United case. And what was particularly amazing about it is that that isn't even what the plaintiffs, Citizens United, have been asking for. Justice Roberts went out of his way to tell the plaintiffs that they hadn't asked for a sweeping enough decision and to please come back and re-argue their case in a way that would allow the Roberts Court to really gut the provisions of the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Act and reverse its recent precedent. So, even aside from the merits of the case, which I disagree with, the process of this case was so far from what John Roberts had promised in his confirmation hearings of not being an activist judge and issuing narrow rulings. Instead he went out of his way to take a manufactured case to take a huge chunk out of recent campaign finance law.
My. Well, we've devoted an entire episode to Citizens United. In fact, it's called What's Wrong with Citizens United. And if people are interested in really focusing on that case, they can find our podcast on iTunes or just Google us online, Your Weekly Constitutional. But that's really all of this, in fact, we've discussed thus far, is in some sense preliminary to the focus of your book. That's the problem as you see it. So you are proposing a solution. What's your solution?
Well, I identify a number of solutions, and my argument is that citizens should be pursuing all of these. But the most straightforward solution would be to overturn the Roberts Court through passing a constitutional amendment that clarified that unlimited campaign spending is not the same thing as free speech, and established some criteria for what limits on paid speech could be, making clear that, you know, we're not proposing a ban on paid speech, but limits that have the effect of leveling the playing field. So that's the most straightforward approach. It would be the most permanent approach, as opposed to, you know, the other way we could prevail would be the same way that James Bach did. You know, we could go back to the court 8 years after Citizens United, and possibly there'd be a change in court personnel depending on how the elections turn out, and possibly the court would reverse itself yet again. And while I might be pleased with that outcome, you know, substantively, it concerns me that our foundational document could ping pong back and forth every 10 years based on, you know, the almost random whims of who lives the longest on the United States Supreme Court. To me, that's
yeah,
not...
but you know, but that points out a very important point. Elections matter. I mean, we're in another election year now. It's 2016 when we're speaking, and it's a very hotly contested election. And you know, there's always that undercurrent of people saying both parties are the same. It doesn't matter who you vote for. But I always have to take issue with that. I think that depending on whether the Democrats win or the Republicans win, we could have a very different Supreme Court in just a few years, because a lot of those guys and those women are getting old.
That's right. And so the next presidential election will be incredibly profound for all sorts of issues, not just
right.
the one that we're talking about today. But I believe there are four justices now that are over 80. And you know, it is possible that if a Democrat wins the White House, we might see the two justices who were appointed by Democrats resign and be replaced, but the other two try to outlive this.
Yeah,
you know,
but that's potentially 8 years. I mean, if you elect
exactly,
somebody.
But if you actually look at the actuarial tables, it's quite conceivable that those folks could live for 8 years. But nonetheless, you're correct that elections matter. I believe that it's appropriate for presidential candidates to state their position on court nominees on this issue. And in fact, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have been quite clear that they've actually used the word litmus test. No, they're not going to put anybody on the Supreme Court that would rule the same way as the Citizens United rule. So that's, and I think every voter should be asking their candidate for the U.S. Senate that same question when it comes to confirming a nominee for the Supreme Court. So elections matter, and that is one immediate way that voters can be engaging in this issue, is through this year's elections process. And
sure. Now, this is the point at which I have to interject. We're nonpartisan here, and so, I mean, I'm simply pointing out that no matter where you stand in this issue, whether somebody listening agrees with you or disagrees with you, the election matters. And so they should ask their candidates, both for the presidency and for the Senate, where they stand on these issues.
Because
there could be some very significant changes in court personnel. It's always somewhat ghoulish to talk about actuarial tables, but, I mean, that's simply the fact. Amending the Constitution is very difficult. It's been done, and it could be done again, but it's very difficult. A change in court personnel is perhaps much more likely, and given the 5-4 division typically on the court for many of these major issues, could be, as you say, profound in its impact. We're getting short on time, so what are the other areas that in your book that you discuss that people can be activist on this issue?
Well, a final tactic that I suggest is a tool that was used widely at the founding period of our country, and actually used to pass the 17th Amendment for direct election of U.S. senators, but called voter instruction measures. And we worked in 2012 to get these on the ballot in Colorado and Montana, and 75% of voters in those states called upon their members of Congress to support a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United. I think we'll be seeing more of those this cycle. In fact, Washington State has just qualified one, and we're on the cusp of getting one on the ballot in California. And those, they may actually prod Congress to pass an amendment, but they may also prod the executive branch to take action, or the judicial branch to have a resolution like we saw during the New Deal. Going back to the opening of the show, we saw a huge change in constitutional jurisprudence through FDR winning huge elections that were campaigning against the United States Supreme Court. And we saw Justice Owen Roberts, not related to John Roberts, but he switched his vote and ended the Lochner era and began upholding the New Deal in recognition that the country had spoken on this issue through executive branch elections and executive branch leadership that was actually threatening to pack the court. So
that's fascinating. That is something that not many people are aware of. So let's go back to that very briefly. You can actually put instructions on a ballot, and the voters in a given state can instruct their elected officials to do certain things.
That's right. And the process for this varies from state to state and locality to locality. And most, you know, lawyers and ledge counselors and city attorneys have forgotten this process exists, quite frankly. Because especially in states that citizens can pass binding legislation through initiative and referendum, they don't have as much of a need to instruct their elected officials. But the concept goes back to the founding period of saying, well, we're going to send a delegate to the Continental Congress, or we're going to send a member to the United States Congress, and generally we'll trust them to represent our community on all these issues that might come up. But there are a few issues that we feel very strongly about that we want to give them explicit instructions on how to represent us. And the members who declared independence from England in the Continental Congress and signed the Declaration of Independence, many of them did so under instructions from their constituents. People at the Philadelphia Convention that drafted our Constitution, many of those delegates were under instructions. So this is a concept of representative democracy that is very old, but that we've let atrophy, and it may be a tool that we can bring back for our current predicament around money and politics.
Well, Derek Cressman, tell us once more before we go, what's the full title of your book?
The book is When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. And as I said, there's some bonus chapters to that available on the website, whenmoneytalks.com.
Well, Derek, thank you very much for your time and for explaining this very interesting area and your proposals to us today. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Sunday is money that matters. Hear what I say.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to author Derek Cressman, telling us about his new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy. Money in politics. I don't think that's controversial, do you? Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.